This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
There's no fence or remnants of a fence. There's nothing to obstruct you from crossing over the railroad tracks.
That's Edouard Prince. He's among the close to 300 people since 2009 arrested for trespassing across the Florida East Coast Railroad tracks right near Northwest 17th Street in Overtown. He says there's nothing to deter people from crossing there.
Trespassing doesn't register in anyone's mind. You know, if you tell somebody you was in somebody's yard, they say, oh, but you was trespassing. That's why you got arrested. But if you tell somebody you cross over the railroad tracks on your way to work and you was arrested, it doesn't register in their mind that you were trespassing. You can't cut the community off like that.
An investigation by WLRN Miami Herald News and the Miami Herald found most of the arrests made by the semi-private Florida East Coast Railway Police in Miami-Dade County were for trespassing around this single spot in Overtown. And this is where we begin this edition of the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We're joined by the reporters behind this investigation, Wilson Sayre from WLRN and David Ovalle from the Miami Herald. Welcome back to both of you to the Florida Roundup. Wilson, the company hasn't discussed this escalation in arrests that you uncovered digging through the police reports and the arrest reports. What led to the increase that you uncovered?
Well, they won't talk to us about what exactly led to it. We have found that most of the arrests are made by one person. And so one of the options is that he was hired and then he stakes out and he arrests people. But we think also that with discussions about All Aboard Florida and that possibility becoming closer and closer reality, that they're not willing to put up with people crossing these tracks, especially where the All Aboard Florida tracks are going to be in the future.
Yeah, David Ovalle with the Miami Herald, All Aboard Florida is designed to be a privately run passenger rail service from Miami to Orlando over the next several years, a multi-billion dollar investment on the part of Florida East Coast Industries. Describe this spot at Northwest 17th Street that has become the focus of this investigation.
Well, if you are to just sort of hang out there and watch people, it's an area, it's an area called Overtown. It's a very you know, poor area, a lot of homeless people going to the homeless shelter, a lot of you know, pedestrians, people that don't have cars that are going to the bus stops or to the public supermarket on Biscayne Boulevard. So it's an area that's a heavy transit area for pedestrians. Is right next to a park, and you can just sit there in any given morning and watch dozens and dozens of people. I mean, it really is quite striking to see how many people are just use it without even thinking about it.
And it's not as if there's a sidewalk there or some kind of path that pedestrians are seemingly guided toward. There is no official crossing at this location, correct?
There is not an official crossing, but if you just, you know, you just sit there and watch people, I don't even think people think twice about it, about crossing there. And there's so few trains that go there on any given week at this moment that most of the people there don't even realize that, even though there is a sign, there mm-hmm. is a sign, but it's really the most direct path to get onto the east side of the railroad tracks going toward downtown area.
David Ovalle with the Miami Herald, Wilson Sayre with WLRN, uncovering a series of arrests made by Florida East Coast Railway over the past 5 years, concentrated in trespassing, concentrated in one rail crossing, and an unofficial rail crossing at Northwest 17th Street that the neighborhood has just kind of made into a rail crossing. Is there a barrier there, Wilson, to stop?
There is not a barrier. There are a couple of pieces of concrete that are littered around, and there, like David said, there is a sign on both sides that says in English and Spanish, no trespassing, and it has a little figure of a guy walking across the tracks. But the 17th Street actually dead ends into that street, so there's no, into the railroad tracks, so there's no outlet. It appears as if perhaps at one point somebody thought about putting in a official crosswalk there, but it is, like David was saying, there on the west side of the tracks, there's a whole neighborhood, and Omni Station on the east side is one of the big hubs for transportation for getting to the metro rail, for getting to the bus, and so or Publix, and so there's this major, you know, cut through that mm-hmm. happens. And the alternative is to walk an extra half a mile north or south to the official pedestrian crosswalk.
David, you spoke with a number of the residents. Did you get a feeling that they acknowledge that this is a public safety danger that they're putting themselves into?
I don't get the sense that most of the people that live there believe this is a high volume place for trains. Now, that being said, it probably will be in the future. And certainly the Florida East Coast Railway has said in the past, at least in mounting some of these police operations, that this is a something designed to get people to realize that that there's a danger that mm-hmm. people could be hit. Specifically, a couple years ago, they mounted a huge operation called Operation Rail Sweep, in which they arrested dozens and dozens of people because, and it just came just after a few weeks after a couple people had been killed, not in this particular stretch of Overtown, but a little bit more north, and one of them was a suicide. So, there have been people hit and killed by trains. That happens, and that's not something that, that is terribly unusual. But certainly, I'm sure they're thinking that, hey, this is something that could happen more now that there's supposed to be an increase in rail traffic.
And yeah, I was out there. Ahead. Wilson, go ahead.
Yeah, I was out there on Wednesday, and I just met this guy who had been arrested multiple times and was just coming home from work and crossing the railroad track. So even when people are arrested, it doesn't seem to deter people.
Yeah, and so let's talk about after the arrest. They get arrested. They get charged. They're not hauled off to jail in most instances, are they, Wilson?
No, in most instances, they will be detained by the police officer. They're fingerprinted there on site. Some of them are handcuffed. And then they're released on scene with what's called a notice to appear in court. So you have a court date that you have to go to.
And when they get to court, how is the court responding to these kinds of charges, David?
Well, almost entirely the cases are either dismissed by the judge or dropped by the prosecutors. It's something where there's such a grind of misdemeanor cases in Miami-Dade court that oftentimes they just use their discretion and just throw away the cases.
Is there anything to hang that discretion on to throw these cases out versus other small so-called kind of misdemeanor issues?
Well, certainly I spoke to one judge who said, look, and this judge said, that many of the cases had been dismissed because there was real concerns that these people have legitimate reasons to be crossing the tracks. It's not like they're loitering on the tracks or doing anything to obstruct the tracks, but they're simply just crossing
right.
and going from one spot to the other. And a lot of the people that would show up in court would say, look, I was just going to work. I was just going to the homeless shelter. I was just going to the bus stop. So there's a lot of concern that this is sort of a waste of judicial and a waste of state resources for the prosecutors.
But the flip side of that, Wilson, is it is a public safety issue. They may be just crossing the track, but they are doing it and acknowledging many of them doing it illegally still.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is definitely illegal. All of the railroad property is private property owned by the Florida East Coast Railway. So as soon as you're stepping onto those tracks, you're on their property. Now, the city has worked out, agreements with the railroad to put in official crosswalks, and sometimes that the railroad has had to ask the city. There's not a sense that this should be something that you are arrested for. Perhaps, somebody should be out there saying, hey, this is something that's dangerous. You shouldn't be doing this. So one, not arresting people, that seems fairly big thing to do. I mean, mm-hmm. that's a big move to, mm-hmm. to arrest people and to put them in the court system, have these arrests on the records, even if they're dropped, even if they're not pursued. And then a lot of people have said, if you're actually concerned about this, if you're really concerned about this one area that has, 90% of these arrests, I mean, you should put up a fence.
Yeah, the arrests are highly concentrated at this one particular location. They're not dispersed up and down the rail line. Highly concentrated, David Ovalle with the Miami Herald, in this one location. So how has that affected the relationship that this neighborhood has with the Florida East Coast Railway semi-private police force, in addition to Miami law enforcement?
Well, certainly it doesn't help. I think in the neighborhood of Overtown, there's historically been distrust between the residents and law enforcement. And that doesn't just go to the railroad police, but that goes to the city of Miami police, right. Just stretches back decades. So this certainly doesn't help them at all in terms of fostering goodwill. And a lot of residents don't really realize that Florida East Coast Railway Police are different than City of Miami Police. A lot of them don't realize it's an actual law enforcement agency. A lot of people have a misunderstanding that FEC Railway Police are just some sort of security. And oftentimes, because people are unfamiliar and unsophisticated with the court system, they don't even realize that this is an arrest on their record because they think it's because they're getting a promise to appear in court. They don't really realize this is a criminal infraction that will go on their record as an arrest.
That will continue. Yeah, David Ovalle with the Miami Herald, Wilson Sarah with WLRN. It's a half mile from this particular illegal rail crossing to a legitimate crossing. The railway's response to this investigation, Wilson, has been?
No response.
David, do you anticipate to hear from the railway folks?
No, and we tried for a very long time, and they pretty much said flat out that they don't discuss ongoing police procedures and policies. I am curious to see the city is aware that this is a pretty heavily used pedestrian area. And a couple months back, they actually sent a letter to the FEC saying, you know, basically on the behalf of the residents and the businesses, would you guys consider putting a pedestrian and car crossing at this one section? And so far, it's just ongoing. It hasn't gone anywhere. There's been no decision. So I think, you know, Wilson and I are both curious to see if this if our story helps spur along that at all.
David Ovalle with the Miami Herald, Wilson Sarah with WLRN, both of them involved in a WLRN Miami Herald investigation into the Florida East Coast Railway police treatment of illegal trespassing of their railroad tracks near Northwest 17th Street in Overtown. Thanks for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. It was 16 months ago that Mount Sinai Medical Center CEO Steve Sonnenreich made national news out of Miami by becoming the first hospital boss in South Florida, maybe even in the nation, to pledge to make public the payment rates his facility receives from insurance companies.
We will post our prices relative to Blue Cross and Aetna, our contractual prices. When I made the pledge, obviously I intended to post our rates. Got back to the hospital, met with our executive management team, and found out that our contracts with the various insurance companies preclude us from releasing that information.
That last part was Sonnenreich just this week here on WLRN, responding to the pledge that he made back in May of 2013. His comments are part of an in-depth series on healthcare prices from WLRN Miami Herald and the Miami Herald this week called Power of Price. Do you know how much your healthcare really costs? Should hospitals and insurance companies make public their contracted rates? Let us know at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, or on Twitter at WLRN. Sammy Mack from WLRN helped with the Power of Price. Dan Chang with the Miami Herald and Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald also led up the coverage as well. All three, welcome back to the Roundup. Sammy, let's begin with you. What role do these non-disclosure agreements play that Sonnenreich cited for not being able to fulfill his pledge?
Well, these non-disclosure agreements are at the heart of the secrecy around the true cost of healthcare. And when we say that, you know, you go to the hospital, there's a charge, and often that charge is way, way more than what you would end up paying as an insured patient, what your insurance company pays on your behalf. And it matters because what your insurance company pays on your behalf is part of what goes into the calculations on premiums, and if you're employed by someone who gives you insurance through work, what they end up ultimately paying for their employer contribution, your employee contribution. And so we don't really know what things cost.
Yeah, and Dan Chang, we have begun to see that question, how much things really cost, being asked on the part of especially organized labor here in South Florida to public municipalities. But they haven't really gotten any kind of clarity or transparency themselves, have they?
Hi, Tom. No, they haven't. They've asked in writing. They've asked in person. The Miami Herald has asked, and WLRN. We've all received similar responses that this is confidential, proprietary information protected by trademarks and other statutes and laws in the state. What's interesting, though, is that AvMed was able to produce some average payments for certain diagnoses and medical procedures
AvMed,
at different facilities.
One of the insurance carriers that we contacted in this series.
That's correct, yes. And those are able to get you close or perhaps near to transparency, but there's too much still that's hard to understand in looking at averages. You don't know details about the patient complexities. You don't know if that payment includes a hospital fee and a physician fee. There's a lot to still be discovered.
And Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald, the complexity that Dan describes, the confusion that Sammy describes, it all leads to continue to provide a lack of clarity for transparency when it comes to healthcare, not only in this community, but nationwide. How's the industry generally been responding to this effort, this call for transparency, but yet the inability of these legal contracts between insurance companies and hospitals to actually provide it?
Well, there is actually a movement at this point to reveal some of the pricing structures, to reveal some of the reimbursement rates that are protected at the moment. In some states, like New Hampshire, they've started a database that allows consumers to actually look at some of the prices that various insurance companies are negotiating with big providers like hospitals. So there is a more and more of an emphasis on this. And it's easy to look at this topic as something that's really wonky and that people don't, you know, their eyes glaze over. But in fact, there are some very practical applications. As an employer, you if you don't know what your pricing, what kind of reimbursement rates your insurance company is paying on your behalf, how are you supposed to make a budget? If you have your budget at home and you get an average for the month on what you're paying for things, how are you supposed to cut down on costs if you need to? And for an employee, that could translate into deductibles. It can translate into premium prices.
Yeah. And Sammy, as we've seen over the course of the better part of a decade, deductibles have been rising, copays have been rising, right, and premiums have been rising. And that's been the impact here.
Yeah. And what's really interesting about what we started to uncover when we started looking into this is we sort of take it for granted that every year healthcare costs are going to rise, and people who work for large employers just know healthcare costs are going up. It's just part of the fabric of how we understand benefits. And it hasn't been until rather recently that people are starting to question that. Well, how do we know? How do we know they're going up? Where's the money going? And at a certain point, you run up against those secret agreements that hide how hospitals are getting paid and other providers are getting paid by the insurers. And as a couple of people I spoke to pointed out, it matters because every dollar that gets spent on a healthcare benefit is a dollar that's not going into an employee's paycheck.
And 49%, I believe it's 49%, Sammy, correct me if I'm wrong, of Americans wind up getting their health insurance through their companies, through their employers. It's darn close to half.
Yeah, for the under 65 crowd, yep.
Right. Over 65, of course, government payers wind up kicking in. Dan Chang with the Miami Herald. There's also the question of relationships between the insurance carriers and the facilities, because the facilities, certainly here in South Florida, are generally large private employers themselves. They're amongst the biggest companies to work for in South Florida, so they have to provide coverage. And so now there's a kind of a trifecta relationship with the insurance company having a contract for the service provider to provide insured coverage for not only their patients, but also their own employees.
That's right, Tom. And one of those large employers, that's a healthcare provider, is Baptist Health South Florida. And of course, they have they're one of the largest private employers in Miami-Dade, if not the largest. It usually changes between them and the University of Miami. And they offer their employees health insurance, of course. And AvMed is one of the health plan managers. And one of the questions that has come up from some of the Miami-Dade County labor unions is how does AvMed negotiate rates on the county's behalf with a provider that's also a client?
Right.
And in some way, it's impossible to avoid Baptist because they're very good and they're very large, and people want to go to them, and they cover geographically an area of South Miami-Dade that is highly populous. And, Baptist says that AvMed is not their only third-party administrator. That's what the plan managers are called. They didn't say who their other plan managers are, but that was sort of the response that they gave. AvMed says that they keep those relationships separate when they negotiate their rates, and that's perhaps one more reason why we need price transparency, is to really see whether or not there's any special advantage given to a provider that's also a client of your plan manager.
And Amy, we've seen these questions really begin to be asked in a very public forum on the part of public labor unions, especially with the school districts and with the counties, hearing more and more from organized labor representatives saying, instead of saying what the contracted rate, the premium increase, we kept it to 3% or kept it to 5%. Let's take a look at under the hood, what's contributing to that. But again, we run up against these legal clauses that are not even allowing behind closed doors labor to get a peek at what's driving healthcare costs in this community.
Right. And labor and the media, we tried to use public records requests to get information. They were turned down. We were told that it was proprietary information, a trade secret, that it would give the hospitals, it would put them at a disadvantage in their own field. So we were unsuccessful in trying to get that information, and so was the union.
Yeah, and we balanced that against other states that have been successful in coming up with these all-payer claims databases to try to provide some transparency. Our coverage of the Power of Price on the Florida Roundup will continue. What transparency tools are there for South Floridian patients, and how do they compare to other states? Plus, who's impacted most by changes in the Bright Futures College Scholarship Program? That a little bit later on. We're back on the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Now, if you have medical insurance through a big carrier like Cigna or United Health, Florida Blue, you may have used their websites to estimate how much a health procedure will cost you. But they're just estimates, and they're just estimates on your immediate out-of-pocket cost, not the real cost of the procedure. This week, WLRN Miami Herald News and the Miami Herald explored the maze of money in the healthcare industry in our series, Power of Price. Sammy Mack with WLRN, Amy Driscoll and Dan Chang with the Miami Herald continue with us here on the Florida Roundup. Sammy, some states are pushing for more public data. Where is the Floridian effort?
So the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration had put in a request during the last budget cycle for about $5 million to start one of these databases. And in general, these databases track exactly who gets paid what. So what hospitals, what doctors get paid what exact amount for the procedure and by whom. So by insurance company. And there's a lot of useful stuff you can do with that information. Mm-hmm. But Florida rejected that budget request. So we are listed as a state that is very interested by the Council of All Payer Claims Databases, which follows this stuff. But right now, we really don't have anything being developed.
But Dan Chang, there is a tool that Florida healthcare supporters and advocates will point out does exist for Floridians to at least get an idea of what a procedure may cost. Is it useful?
Well, it's not useful really probably for identifying your own personal costs, because they're really going to vary depending on your insurance plan, the type of coverage that you have, everything that we've talked about leading right up to here, your deductible, even coinsurance rates. But there is a website called floridahealthfinder.gov where you can see charges. So the state does require, it has about, I want to say it's enacted about a dozen or so statutes over the last few years, or amended them to require transparency, but really it's mostly from hospitals, not from insurers. Insurers are the ones who know what they pay everybody and would probably be in a better position to really tell you what those payments are. But hospitals are required here to report what they charge. And as we mentioned earlier, there's a very big difference between the charge and the actual payment or price.
Yeah, without too much semantics, right? The charge is maybe the asking price, but the accepting cost in terms of what the hospital gets reimbursed for can be a lot different.
Often at a steep discount,
65%
off of the charge price, if you will. So that's what Florida has. So Florida consumers do have that as a resource. And they also, you know, I hope one of the outcomes of these stories is that consumers begin to engage their providers more in these conversations. Even if they don't have the exact price, they can at least get them talking about it. And they might not get a lot of answers, but the more they ask, the more that I think providers will become accustomed to thinking about this.
And Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald, that's an important point that Dan makes, because it's happening at a time when more and more Floridians are entering the health insurance market via the Affordable Care Act. And some of these folks may or may not have any experience in insurance. And we'll have to see in the months ahead, because we're beginning to get some of the data in terms of how many Floridians are covered, how many are verified, how many are unverified, and moving into this market quickly.
That's true. There are a lot of people now who will be looking at insurance for the first time and figuring out how much they actually have to pay in terms of co-pays and deductibles. And that price, where they choose to go and for a procedure, can make a huge difference to them. One of our stories, we had a man get a CAT scan. It was priced at $9,000. It was paid at $1,800, but another place down the street could have done it for $350.
Yeah, think of the price differentiation there from $9,000, Dan, down to in the neighborhood of less than $400 is the price range available if you're able to shop around.
That's right. And again, those were charges. This was a gentleman on Medicare, and Medicare doesn't negotiate like private insurers right. does. It pays you your rate based on their formula, and that's it, and just like Medicaid does as well. And, you know, that's a difference between hospitals and freestanding diagnostic centers that don't have all of the overhead that a hospital does. You know, they don't have the physician and nursing staff 24 hours a day yeah. and all of the other services.
That's on the service side. On the payer side, it's the difference between a marketplace and a single payer, Medicare, in the case of this particular issue. So I want to ask all three of you, who's got the leverage in this case? Where's the leverage in the transparency effort, do you think, Dan?
I think the consumers have a lot of leverage right now because they're the ones who ultimately the insurance companies want to sell to and who the providers want to provide their services to. And, you know, a lot of consumers are led to buy insurance plans based on that monthly premium. They want to know what their monthly premium is going to be, and they're going to pick a low one. Yeah. Well, most of the time when you pick a low monthly premium, you're going to have high out-of-pocket costs, high deductibles, probably have a higher co-insurance, high co-payments. You know, if you pay a little bit more in your premium, you're going to be able to reduce those and in the long run, pay less perhaps for your healthcare. So as consumers demand and need this information more, I think they have a lot of leverage to persuade legislators to enact legislation that requires this type of reporting.
Arguably, though, Amy, that the insurance marketplace separates consumers from the real cost because of this lack of transparency. You think that the leverage in this debate is still with the consumers?
Well, I think it's with consumers and large employers. But for consumers who have traditionally had most of their coverage paid for by their employer, they've been insulated from these costs. As that is changing, and it is for most people, the leverage is actually shifting more to the employer, who I think could go back and say we need to see our own data. Yeah. We need to be able to plan better and budget better.
Yeah, and Sammy Mack with WLRN, we've seen those employers through the many years, you know, continue to cost shift the increases they've experienced on premiums more and more to the employer to the employee.
Right, which goes back to what Dan was saying about the sort of individual customer having the leverage here. I think as employees, especially when you look at large government employers like the counties or the school districts, when you look at how they have had to cost shift, and that means, you know, getting their employees to pay more money, and how the employees are responding to this, they're at a point where I think a lot of people are starting to question where the money is going, and that is forcing their bosses to question where the money is going. And when you have enough people in your district or your county, I think they have more power than they've realized in the past, or that they've leveraged in the past.
Sammy Mack with WLRN, Dan Chang, and Amy Driscoll with the Miami Herald, heading up the Power of Price series of reports that we had this week with WLRN and Miami Herald. You can see all the reporting at WLRN.org/price. Thank you to the three of you. As we continue here on the Florida Roundup, certainly healthcare prices provide their own mystery, but a political mystery of sorts was solved this week. Who's the guy in the Rick Scott for Governor campaign TV ad claiming he was cheated by Ponzi schemer Scott Rothstein and former Governor Charlie Crist?
Scott Rothstein swindled a lot of people, me included. He bankrupted many families. Nobody was closer to Rothstein than Charlie Crist.
Now, the media had been asking Governor Scott and his campaign to identify the man in the ad. They would not reveal his name.
Rothstein was always around Charlie, throwing parties and giving Charlie money. Rothstein bragged that he gave Charlie Crist money so he could pick judges. Of course Charlie took the money. I got swindled by both Rothstein and Charlie.
That's Dean Kretschmar from Fort Lauderdale, an investor. Solving the mystery in this case was Miami Herald political reporter Mark Caputo. Governor Scott, by the way, stuck with the claim this week in Miami that is central in the ad.
The ad's absolutely true. I mean, this individual was a victim of both Scott Rothstein and Charlie Crist.
Mark Caputo joins us now here in studio. John O'Connor covering politics and education for us at WLRN as well. Mark, first of all, any evidence that the guy in the ad, Dean Kretschmar from Fort Lauderdale, was swindled by the former governor?
Well, I think Governor Rick Scott is right. The ad is absolutely true if you redefine the definition of absolutely and true. The ad's not true. There's really no evidence that he was swindled, Dean Kretschmar. The ad revolves around Ponzi schemer Scott Rothstein and his relationship with Charlie Crist. It says nothing about what Rick Scott now says is the swindle.
Right.
And Rick Scott now says the swindle is that Charlie's a flip-flopper, and therefore Dean Kretschmar was swindled by this guy. And it's like, yeah, if you redefine swindled, you redefine absolutely and redefine true. Sure, it's absolutely true.
We're good to go.
Yeah, he was swindled. Yeah.
There was a relationship between Scott Rothstein and Charlie Crist. That's undeniable.
Undeniable, yes. What the then-Governor Crist was relied on Scott Rothstein to steer him quite a bit of campaign finance money, including to the Republican Party of Florida. And like most governors, he appointed one of his donors to a board. In this case, it was a judicial nominating commission. Now, it should be said that Governor Rick Scott has a major donor named William R. Scherer, who is a Fort Lauderdale trial attorney who just so happens to be Dean Kretschmar's lawyer. And it just so happens to be that William R. Scherer is a appointee to a judicial nominating commission. And it just so happens that judicial nominating commission appointed Scherer's daughter to a federal position on a bench. Now, I'm not saying this is illegal, but this stuff happens all the time. The court complaint that Rothstein has now said in federal court was looked at by the FBI, by the U.S. Attorney's Office, and according to our sources and everything we've seen, and also the statute of limitations, they found no evidence of a crime, and they're not investigating anymore.
With the former governor.
Correct.
Right, right. Mark Caputo with the Miami Herald, John O'Connor with WLRN. John, assess the tactics that this particular advertisement on the part of the current governor is a symptom of.
So the fundamental characteristic of this campaign is that you have two candidates who are hated more than they're liked. It's kind of a historic situation. And so as you know, we've seen with the ads from both candidates, you know, it's not vote for me because of this. It's don't vote for this guy because, you know, he's worse than I am. So, you know, I'm the better choice for that reason. You know, all negative, tearing down the other guy rather than, you know, making a pitch as to why you are the better candidate.
For years and for many, many campaigns, Mark, and we know that negative advertising can work and be very effective. Do we know anything about the effectiveness of this ad? I mean, it's a couple million dollars that the campaign has bought in airtime across the state for this one 30-second commercial.
Anecdotally, we do. I mean, the amount of emails and calls I've gotten from people both before and after our story came out spoke to the effectiveness of the ad. Negative ads do work on the whole. Probably, you know, 80% of Scott's roughly $27 million ad buy has been negative. Yeah. He's outspending Charlie Crist about 3-1. Crist is also just as negative. The difference is that there's more negativity trained on him. So what's happened over time is that Scott's favor, or better said, Charlie Crist's favorables have been dragged down. So there's a problem for Crist and not for Scott in this, is that negative campaigning, while people pay attention to it, generally helps depress the electorate. The smaller the electorate, statistics and data show, the more likely it is that Democrats and liberal-minded voters stay home. So therefore, Scott wins in both regards.
And finally, I want to get back to the semantics in this particular ad, because, Mark, as you alluded to, it is a bit about defining what swindle is. When we're talking about particular 30-second ad, is impossible to assess you know, any kind of candidacy, any kind of veracity of a candidate's ability to hold public office. But when it gets down to these vague and gauzy kind of words that are used that turn into accusations, it doesn't do the process any good, does it, John?
Not particularly, but I mean, I think to be honest, we as journalists sometimes take advantage of some of those same tactics when we, you know, can't say something as definitively as we like. We soften the language a little bit. It's pretty common. And it's especially common in a campaign, is, you know, as you see here now, he tries to retreat to a defensible position on the ad by changing some of the definitions or changing what he said his intent was for why he used that word.
Let's move on to an issue that we do know is a bona fide issue in this campaign for governor, and that being education. Fewer Florida high school graduates are qualifying for the Bright Futures College Scholarship Program thanks to higher standards that were put in place by the state legislature. Jake Seiler is one of those graduates who missed out due to the new qualifications. WLRN spoke with Jake and his dad, Paul.
It affects all the wrong people, the people that are on the edge and maybe don't test as well, that maybe haven't had the benefits of going to specialized training. Those people are the ones being pushed out. Those who already had the advantages, who are already going to be successful, and probably in most cases don't need the money, those folks are unaffected by this change.
When I found out that I made the scores that were available last year and it wasn't this year, I was very confused. It's like, I'm sorry I was born the wrong year for that to happen.
John, you spoke with Jake Seiler. What does he mean, born the wrong year for this to happen?
Well, Jake has two older siblings, a sister and a half-sister, and both of them scored lower on the SAT, both of them scored lower on the SAT than he did, and both of them qualified for Bright Futures, and he did not. And that's a factor of the legislature a few years ago passed changes that raised the required SAT and ACT scores over a three-year period. That really kicked in this year. The required score jumped by 150 points. That's a 15% increase in 1 year. And so Jake would have qualified last year, but not this year.
We got an email question from a listener at theFloridaRoundup@WLRNnews.org. That's the email address. Alyssa, she's a tutor, and she notes that she's been teaching the SAT for 25 years. To this jump in scores that you talk about, John, she mentions the score of 550 is in the 67th percentile approximately. That achievement should not be rewarded. The listener continues on, a score of 600 still is only in the 85% percentile. Is that worthy of a scholarship? So is it a matter of the level of the qualification or the rate of the increase, this big jump, as you mentioned, in 1 year?
There's a couple things going on. The levels for there's two Bright Futures levels. One is the academic scholars. Those SAT scores are at the 89th percentile, so you're talking the top 11% of the kids in the country. The new standards for the medallion scholars, which is the next level down, which is what Jake Seiler missed out on, is set at 75th percentile. So when Bright Futures was established, it was pretty clear pretty quickly that the program was unsustainable. It was offering scholarships to too many kids. The cost of college was increasing at a rate that the lottery funding for the scholarship program couldn't support. So here's where we come back to the question, the policy question of what qualifies as, you know, a level of scholarship that should be rewarded. Lawmakers, John Legge, the senator, Senate Education Committee chairman, said that, you know, they took some fairly recent research that showed that kids who could reach these scores that they have now set had a better chance of graduating college and of not losing those scholarships. And so that's why they said, okay, we're going to move it to this level. Here's what research says we should move it to.
John O'Connor covering education and politics for us at WLRN. Mark Caputo writing about politics throughout the state of Florida. We talk about the policy here, the education, higher education policy. What are the politics involved with this, Mark?
Well, I think the politics and the policy are closely intertwined. What we're talking about is a penny-pinching legislature when it comes to education. And that spans the educational spectrum. And what we do know is that generally Black and Hispanic students, generally speaking, minority students are poorer. And we do know that poorer students fare more poorly on standardized tests and in schools. And what's happened over the years is that as the cost of college tuition has gone up, Bright Futures became kind of a de facto stopgap mechanism to help subsidize the cost of college and deal with this inequity that is kind of built into the system as part of the system. So now that they've made these changes, and one of my favorite things in the legislature to do is whenever a legislator says, oh, this is not about that, that means that this is about that.
Right.
So when John Legge said in your report, oh, this isn't about saving money, trust me, I covered the budget for almost a decade in Tallahassee. It's about saving money. The budget's about money.
And this week, the state universities talked about needing $45 million additional dollars in financial aid. Board of Governors controlling the state universities discussed this issue. What's the next step in this?
Well, the next step was to delay it until after the election because
the next step was to give Rick Scott political cover. That's what
it was. Because, I mean, this $45 million that they're asking for is was intended to go to needs-based aid. So it's intended to address some of these inequities that they directly caused by changing the requirements for these scholarships. So, you know, money for kids coming, you know, low-income kids, right, or Black or Hispanic students.
John O'Connor, covering education, state impact reporter here at WLRN. Mark Caputo, all things politics for the Miami Herald. Always great to see both of you. Thanks for your time today. Still to come on the Florida Roundup, the crime of abortion in El Salvador and how it may be sending women to prison and here to South Florida. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Christina Quintana was 18 and pregnant when she suffered a miscarriage. She woke up in a hospital and wound up behind bars.
Me detuvieron dentro del quirófano donde...
They arrested me while I was in surgery. I was handcuffed to the bed. They didn't care how badly I was hemorrhaging or how terrified I was.
She was just one of scores of women in El Salvador sentenced to prison after being convicted of having an abortion. The procedure has been outlawed there since 1999. No exceptions, none for rape, none for incest, none if the woman's health is in danger. Tim Padgett wrote about it this week and reported on it for the Latin American Report here on WLRN. Jackie Charles covers the Caribbean and Haiti for the Miami Herald, both with us now here on the Florida Roundup. Where is this woman now, Tim?
Unfortunately, because she was let out of, she was given a 30-year sentence because they jacked up the charge from abortion to aggravated murder. After serving 5 years in prison, she was let out because even the judges there knew that this was an excessive punishment. But even so, it became impossible for her to find a job because her criminal record stuck, and she was wearing the scarlet letter. Couldn't find a job, and so she and her little daughter then made their way up to the United States through Mexico, and now she's living in Chicago.
And the situation that El Salvadorian women face, still the same as what she faced? Still illegal?
Oh, even worse. Yeah. In fact, you know, the government has sort of doubled down, it appears. Not so much the government, but prosecutors and judges are doubling down in the face of increasing condemnation of this law. And I think the reason it is, you know, getting this condemnation is because it doesn't really matter whether you're pro-life or pro-choice in this case. If you're pro-life, even if you're pro-life, this can't be the way you intended anti-abortion legislation to be carried out. It's not just the inordinate incarceration these women are facing, but also the witch hunt ugliness involved. The presumption that any woman who comes into an ER hemorrhaging in El Salvador must have induced an abortion.
What is the kind of community within Central America, Latin America, in the Caribbean, Jackie? I suppose the acceptance is one way to ask the question of this kind of criminalization of abortion.
Well, it's interesting because I covered the same topic last year out of Haiti, where there are similar laws. And I was reminded after talking to two young ladies who had undergone abortion that they can be arrested. You can be arrested because you had an abortion. You can be arrested because you gave an abortion or that you encouraged somebody to give it. I mean, the Caribbean in general is this very conservative place. And, you know, and it varies in terms of what the abortion laws are, but very much so that there is this legality issue in terms of if you go and decide to have an abortion, you're basically taking a huge legal risk.
Yeah, putting yourself at a big criminal risk in this
case.
Yeah. I want to talk about some politics that are going on in Haiti because there has been letters sent not only to political leaders in Haiti, but also continued pressure on the White House on the part of several U.S. lawmakers, including a large contingency of South Floridian legislators, to do a couple of things. I mean, one is to have an election in Haiti. What is the status of elections that they need to hold before January of next year?
Well, there's a building school of thought that that's not going to happen. The elections were scheduled for October 26th, and a few weeks ago, the Electoral Council told President Michel Martelly that it was impossible to do that. We still need an electoral law. And what has happened is that these group of U.S. lawmakers and others in the U.S. government have focused sort of their attention on six opposition senators. Mm-hmm. But what they neglect to mention is that the major political parties at least five of them are also opposed, not to elections, but to the way that this electoral law is basically being managed. And the fact that they do not have confidence in the formation of the Electoral Council. They believe that the executive controls it. Therefore, they will try to steal the election. And they also said that this agreement that was carved up was an agreement, it's called the El Rancho Accord, that it's an agreement between political parties and it bypasses the Constitution. That is their main argument, that you are asking us to approve something that is unconstitutional and that we cannot do it.
In the meantime, Tim, the Obama White House is where on this?
I don't think they really know where to be, because this has become so muddled in regards to the fact that the political opposition in Haiti had leverage over Martelly on this issue, and now all of a sudden they're the ones who are looking like they're obstructing. Yeah. They're essentially snatching defeat from the jaws of victory in this case, and I don't think the White House or anybody else here understands that.
Well, it's interesting, and I spoke to Congresswoman Maxine Waters a few days ago, and she had written a letter to the Secretary of State Kerry about this. And the response that she got back from the Haiti desk was that these opposition senators are saying they're not going to vote the electoral law until the Prime Minister, Laurent Lamothe, is no longer PM. Mm. So I was shocked at how the U.S., State Department is basically just boiling all of this down to the fact that we want the Prime Minister gone, and did not mention at all in this letter the constitutional arguments that are being raised.
Jackie Charles covering the Caribbean and Haiti for the Miami Herald. Tim Padgett covering Latin America and the Caribbean for us here on WLRN. I want to bring the conversation back to the U.S. for one more topic here on the Florida Roundup. And it's been a little bit more than a week now that the talk around professional sports in the NFL has been on domestic and child abuse, not on football at all. Michelle Kaufman writes about sports and football, certainly, for the Miami Herald, and she joins us now via Skype. The storyline here, Michelle, is not new for the NFL, but the video evidence that we've seen, the graphic results that we've seen, fresh in fans' minds, and the league itself this time around really finds itself under scrutiny, not necessarily any particular team like we saw last season with the Dolphins and the bullying scandal in the locker room. What's changed?
I don't really think anything has changed. I just think that TMZ released a very shocking video. There have been cases of domestic violence in the past. You know, the Dolphins have dealt with five since the year 2000, which I want to point out, by the way, the numbers are actually lower for NFL players than they are for the arrests for domestic violence are far lower for NFL players than they are for non-NFL players. But anyway, it's not that there's an epidemic. It's not that all of a sudden NFL players are now hitting their spouses and girlfriends and they weren't before. It's just that the issue is really being heightened by this video that was so shocking. This incident happened in February. Right. It was in the news. There was no outrage. There were no panels. People weren't talking about it 24/7 on TV then.
But we are certainly now, Michelle. Let me ask you, though, the reaction in the locker room at the Dolphins is they went through last season with that locker room under intense scrutiny, not because of domestic abuse, but because of, internal psychological abuse that had been going on. I mean, are nerves frayed? I mean, what's the Dolphins locker room reaction?
No, the Dolphins locker room reaction is kind of similar to what it was last year, which is, please don't paint a broad brush. We're not all like this. Mm. Yes, there are incidents of guys who do stupid things, guys who make mistakes, guys who commit crimes, just like any segment of the population. And they, a lot of them, they resent the fact that their character is smeared because there are bad apples and there are bad people in the NFL, and there are. I mean, there's no question what Ray Rice did is reprehensible. Yeah. It's horrible, it's violent, and we've all seen it now, and that's why everybody's talking about it, because everyone can see the video, and the video can be shown over and over and over again.
Michelle Kaufman writing about some of the Dolphin reaction to what's been going on in the NFL in the first few weeks of this season, writer for the Miami Herald. Michelle, thanks for joining us here quickly on the Florida Roundup.
Sure.
Finally, on this edition here, we do want to introduce you to the newest member of Marvel Comics Avengers, Captain Citrus.
You know Marvel's Avengers. Iron Man, Thor, Black Widow, Captain America. But who is Captain Citrus? And how is he powered by the Amazing Five?
Whet your appetite there. Who is Captain Citrus? Well, he is not some rotund, spherically shaped, happy-go-lucky fruit man. He instead He's buffed, dark-haired, six-pack ab with the superhero, and a shield promoting the powers of Florida's orange juice. He's also a million-dollar man, by the way. The Florida Department of Citrus paid Marvel Entertainment $1 million for the makeover for its superhero, I suppose, in this case. That is the Florida Roundup for this program. Thanks again for listening. Thank you to all of our guests and online posters and callers. The Florida Roundup is produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Gina Jordan, and Julia Duba. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. Technical supervisor for this broadcast is Paul Leary. Thank you, sir. South Florida Arts Beat is up next, and Ed Bell speaks with the filmmakers behind Deep City, The Birth of the Miami Sound. Monday morning at 9 on the Sunshine Economy, we'll be back with the music business in South Florida. We'll talk with you then. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening.